This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have concerns, of course, all across Indiana about some of the latest cases of coronavirus, also the illness itself known as COVID-19. It's into Lake County now with three reports of persons confirmed with the illness. State Representative Mara Candelaria-Reardon, who's a Democrat from Munster, is with us to talk about at least the state's response so far to the crisis. And Representative Reardon, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, first, your thoughts in general here about what has happened and certainly the response so far here in Indiana.
Well, Chris, I think that we have a real opportunity here in Indiana to contain this virus. And, I want to preface my remarks by saying I am not a medical professional, and I want to thank all the medical professionals that are dealing with this on the front lines and trying to contain the virus and that show up for work every day on those front lines. That's something that we can all be grateful for. Second, I want to say that, Hoosier families, businesses, our healthcare system has taken a serious hit, and we really need to contain the virus. We really need to make sure that our state government that does not have the capacity or the resources to address this pandemic on its own avails itself of the necessary federal funding and waivers to help provide relief for those families and businesses across our state. And as well, they need to support our healthcare system and our workers.
I know that there's the concern, of course, about the fact that from a national level, that there's been comments, complaints from some that not enough was done soon enough, and that we're playing catch up now. Do you think that Indiana is in that situation, or do you think that we're trying to stay ahead of the curve as much as we can?
I think that we're in the same situation as everybody is nationally. We're behind the eight ball. We knew this was coming. I think that we had a very slow response from our federal government, and certainly relying on them has come at our detriment. We are trying to, now we are putting in place some of the safeguards and things that should have been here before. Testing kits, for one. We don't have them. We don't have them. We don't have enough of them.
Mm-hmm. I know that Dr. Woody Myers, the former health commissioner here in Indiana, who is now running for governor on in the primary election coming up here, has offered up some ideas, his thoughts, strategy to deal with the coronavirus issue. If you will, give us an idea, at least what you think of what he has to say, his ideas, and how you'd like to see them implemented, if they are.
I think that you've got to, you've got somebody in Dr. Myers, you've got somebody that has dealt with a health crisis in the HIV health crisis back in the 90s. And you've seen that, you've seen how well he handled that. And I think it's important for us to take that heed and understand that he knows about these issues, right? He knows about containing diseases that are contagious and viruses that are contagious.
I know, too, there's also the concern about, from a business standpoint, and you being a business person, aside from being a state lawmaker, are certainly aware of this, the concern about the issues out there of hoarding, of supply shortages and the like, and no doubt you were probably, among others, over this past weekend, may have witnessed the fact that it was difficult to get around in the supermarkets. So you wanted to have a little bit of a protective space around you, at least to avoid from catching the bug, so to speak. But the idea was that it was very difficult to get many items out there because shelves were quickly disappearing of items and concerns about hoarding and the like. Do you think that that the state of Indiana, number one, can do something or at least towards something about the issue? And I know that there is concern, too, about such things as price gouging out there, too, for items that people feel that they need.
I think that you're going to see bad actors in every situation, and I think it's a communication issue. I mean, people are hoarding things like water. There's no indication that our water supply is going to be affected in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. We have some of the best water that you can get in Lake County. We have a giant, supply from Lake Michigan of water. It's just about education and communication, and people, when there are times of crisis, need to hear from their government, and they need to hear that things are under control, and that there's not a fear that we're going to lose our water supply. And I think that, you know, that's one big thing. I think people try to find some modicum of control in their lives when they're in crisis, and you know, having, you know, toilet paper stacked to the ceiling might feel like control to people, and you have to understand where they're coming from and meet them where they are.
Yeah, I've seen some reports, and some people are recommending if you need to save something back, save back for a couple weeks. But beyond that is like you say, is hoarding. It's anticipating something that may or may not happen, and you shouldn't have to worry about that.
No, I mean, I agree. And I mean, we should be talking about things that the government can do better. Mm-hmm. We can increase the eligibility for unemployment insurance by earning requirements and expediting claims for Medicaid for those people that are going to need medical attention. You know, things like requiring employers to implement emergency programs for the next, you know, 4 weeks of paid family, you know, paid leave for their employees. You know, we've got to waive co-pays for those who use the Healthy Indiana Plan. There are, you know, disbursements that we can make for the 2021 fiscal year right now for food banks across our state that are experiencing a higher than normal volume of traffic. Those are real things that we can do as state government to assuage those concerns and stop, you know, people from feeling the need to hoard products that they ultimately may not even need.
I know there's also been, you talk about the bad actors that are out there, but there also have been some so-called good actors as well. We're talking about organizations besides the food bank of some of the school districts that are doing the best they can to help their particular patrons. What comes to mind, of course, is the Hanover Community Schools down in Southlake County offering up some bag lunches for family members that have youngsters that normally would be getting help at school with lunches or even breakfasts and are not being able to do so because schools are closed right now because of the coronavirus pandemic. Do you think we need to have more good actors like that step up and take over?
I couldn't agree more. And you see that all across, not just in South County, you see it all across Lake County here. Mm-hmm. In particular. You see school districts and communities coming together. There's a lot of positivity around making sure that kids that are on that free and reduced lunch program, that this might be the only meal of the day that they have. And so there are, you know, efforts all across this county to make sure that people get fed and that, you know, children are safe and they have, you know, some continuity in their lives, that, you know, they can still go to their school for some of their needs. And I think that you see that. You see schools being such an important part of kids' lives. And so when they close the school, this gives them a little bit of security, and it's not just about the meal. It's about knowing that that's where they can go to nourish their bodies and their souls.
Now, we should probably also mention, too, that Gary Community School Corporation is doing the same with set up. Yes. For food distribution sites around the city because of the same reason we mentioned here, the fact that so many youngsters in the Gary School District have to rely on additional help, and that lunch or that breakfast is very important for them, and they won't have that now, for at least for a while anyway. So,
Absolutely. It's very important. Okay. To give them that continuity and that security.
In closing, Representative Reardon, any thoughts that you feel we should probably keep in mind as we continue forward dealing with the social separations that we have to deal with, distances, I guess, to stay well and to look at other precautions in turn to stay healthy during this crisis?
I think it's really, really important that we take the advice of medical professionals and follow the guidelines set by our government. It's very, very important that we do that to be able to contain this virus. As we've talked about in the past, it's not necessarily there are carriers and there are people that are vulnerable. And you may have this, you may have the virus, and it may not affect you the way it affects other people. We have to be cognizant of vulnerable populations. My father is 90 years old. I'm very, very concerned that he stay home and does not expose himself to other people outside I have limited my contact with my father as well because I'm concerned about, you know, bringing something to him that he can't fight off. And I think that the more that people understand that this is very serious, and the better off we're going to be. Community.
Well, certainly, thank you very much for that advice. And if we follow the guidelines that are set forth, we're all going to get through this without any problem, I would hope. And we know even the people, unfortunately, who have been confirmed with having COVID-19 are going to do well. And if they're well taken care of, which, of course, they are, because they're in hospital, or even if they're just in self-quarantine at home, to be sure. And thank you very much for spending time to talk about the issue, your thoughts about it, and at least your feelings that that state government should do to follow through and make things better, faster for everybody.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. And I do believe that we will, this too shall pass. We need to take precautions and be smart about the way we interact, and, you know, we'll all get through it.
That's true. There, too. The State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon here in Lake County. And thank you very much for joining us here on the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Kids across Indiana and even in Michigan are home from school, and they've been encouraged to stay away from older relatives to reduce the risk of COVID-19, of spreading COVID-19. But how do you explain to your youngsters all of these unprecedented changes? Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart spoke with a psychologist from the University of Notre Dame about how to talk to the kids about coronavirus.
My name's Darsha Narvaez. I am a professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame.
Okay, so what should parents be doing right now as far as explaining things like COVID-19 and why schools are closed? What should parents be telling their kids?
Well, I think it matters how old the child is. For younger children, let's just assume the child is young, to say things like, everyone gets sick, you get colds, I get colds, and we have to stay home from school or from work to rest and get better. And sometimes, however, we get sick and we don't really know we're sick because our body's pretty strong and healthy and keeps us from feeling it. And the coronavirus is sort of like this. For some people, they don't feel like they're getting sick, or they are sick and they can walk around with the virus. For other people, if they get the virus, they get very sick. And so it's really important to know that you can have it but not feel bad, but it means you can pass it to someone else. Because if you cough on them, or you've been licking your fingers or something, and then you touch them, and then they touch themselves, their face, they can get sick from you. So it's really important to understand that the virus can be in people and you don't even know it, and you can pass it along to other people who are really vulnerable.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of parents that are concerned about who their children come into contact with as far as older relatives, grandparents.
That's right. Some people are more susceptible to this virus and they can get really sick and they can die from it. But we have to make sure that we do our social distancing, which means that we stay home when we can. We stay away from people 6 feet away and keep them from getting sick just in case we're carrying it in our bodies and we don't really know it.
What about what parents should tell kids about, particularly younger kids who aren't going to be in school for a while? This is going to be kind of a strange time for them without that kind of social safety net that school provides.
Right. So it's going to vary now by family here as to what impact it has. I'm kind of biased towards play in childhood. So it's a great opportunity for parents to be able to let their children play in all sorts of ways that maybe they don't get a chance to. So being out in the yard in particular, being out in nature, watching the birds or trees or ants, whatever is available, and study those things and get interested and play together, making up things, creative play, all sorts of wonderful things can happen outside of school. School for young children is very hard often because you have to sit still for so long and focus on books. And now this is a great chance to do other things that actually help build the brain. Play is what kids should be doing throughout childhood because it builds the brain and builds social-emotional intelligence when you play with others.
What about some older kids who might be taking not being at school as not being with their friends and not having that sort of environment for them, maybe like older elementary, middle school kids?
Yes, and this is where now the media, the social media, and connecting via phones and iPads and computers is actually a good thing. I usually recommend against spending very much time that way because it doesn't help our brains grow that well in the right ways. But now this is a time to use those tools because they give us a chance to feel connected in a way. It fools our brains maybe a little bit into feeling that when we talk to grandma or grandpa or our friend on FaceTime, you feel a little bit, you know, like there's some energy there, and that's really important. And I think we have to let kids have those social times.
All right. Is there anything else that you think parents should definitely be doing with regards to helping their kids through an unprecedented time?
I think it's a great opportunity to help children imagine how they can best connect with others. And I'm thinking specifically of grandma and grandpa. They should be concerned about touching grandma and grandpa or being near them, but they can still do things via FaceTime or the phone, and they can do things that are creative to make grandma and grandpa feel better or whoever it is that they're not face-to-face with. So you can ask your child to make up, get some jokes going, so you can tell a joke to grandpa, or make up a song or a story that they're going to tell them to try to make others feel better. So instead of just thinking about what I'm missing and what I can't do, think about how you can help the other people who are more isolated than you, who are more in more danger, and help them feel good by the things that you can create and do.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
The school closures caused by COVID-19 not stopping the Gary Community School Corporation's emergency manager, Paige McNulty, from being engaged with students. Dr. McNulty launched a storytime program via YouTube on Tuesday, where several administrators and community leaders are recorded reading children's books aloud. Gary Mayor Jerome Prince joined Dr. McNulty and her sons in the storytime, and the videos are posted on the Gary Community School Corporation's YouTube page. A different story will be posted on occasion on the school district's social media pages in the hopes that they'll be widely shared among parents and families. Coming up, it's Green Fleet Radio. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Today, our guest is Mr. Peter Clevering. He's the Marketing Director for Homewood Disposal Service. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
So, Peter, tell our listeners a little bit about Homewood Disposal.
Sure. Well, Homewood Disposal is a family-owned garbage company. And kind of as the name hints at, we are located in Homewood, Illinois, but we also have many other locations in Northwest Indiana and throughout the Chicago suburbs. So although the name Homewood is a little regional, we do serve all Northwest Indiana and most of Chicago.
Sure. In fact, I saw a couple of the trucks today on my way into the studio.
Yeah, we're recognizable. That's those teal trucks, so they're hard to miss.
So I know Homewood Disposal has been involved with compressed natural gas in its fleet for probably about 10 years. How did that originally come about, and why did you decide to go that route, Peter?
Yeah, so you're right. It's been about 10 years. So kind of have a culture of, I guess we would call it stewardship here, where we really care about the environment, and that connects with how we handle our customers' recyclables and their waste. But CNG fuel kind of seemed like the next step in that process, and that's when we kind of started investigating that. And CNG as an alternative fuel was kind of the most tested and safe product that we found and had the best infrastructure. So it seemed like the right choice for us. So yeah, we've been doing that for about 10 years for our trucks now.
So how many CNG trucks do you have now in your fleet?
I think as of this year, we have about 110 CNG trucks.
Wow.
Most of the newer ones we get are CNG if we're able to get those.
Wonderful. So how did your drivers like the trucks, and was that a hard sell to your employees?
Well, change is always a little difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something new, and the guys like their routes and like to do it well. But once we train them, and we consistently train them about CNG safety and how to fuel and, why it's better for the environment, it hasn't been a hard sell after that first initial sell, right? So it's just who we are now.
Sure.
So there's no real pushback anymore. Yeah, this first was a little difficult because it was changed, but now it's just who we are. We have CNG trucks.
Sure, and I know Home of Disposal also has its own CNG stations and public stations. So what made you decide to expand your business into fueling?
Well, it just seemed like the next step. It kind of connected with that stewardship aspect. If we're going to be doing it, why not give that opportunity to others who are also, you know, trying to use CNG to have it out there? And the infrastructure is there. It's right next to our, you know, our trucks fuel overnight in those parking lots. And it wasn't a big leap to enable others to fuel up near us, too.
They're very nice stations. And so I know you also recently had some assistance from some grant funding to support your efforts. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have had some grant funding for our CNG installations of stations and for some of the trucks. Recently, the VW grant, with the help of South Shore Clean Cities, we were able to obtain some money to purchase three CNG trucks for Northwest India. Two of those are they're called a roll-off truck, and those are the ones with the dumpsters on the back, and then one is a commercial truck.
So how can our listeners learn more about Home of Disposal and some of the services you offer and more about your fleet?
Yeah, so if you go to mydisposal.com, or you just type in Home of Disposal, you know, in your search engine, you'll find us too. And then just search for CNG there on our site. It's pretty easy to find. You can find more about our fleet, and you can find out more about our public fueling stations. We have two of those.
So any upcoming exciting things that Home of Disposal has planned?
One exciting thing that we're planning right now is a great kids education section of our website about recycling. So it's a really cool place on our site that you can learn more about how to recycle. It's all based for kids, videos, activities. Really simple information so kids can get in recycling and that next generation can really come alongside and, you know, push through the recycling efforts.
Well, and that's where it all begins, right, Peter? Right in school and you know, keeping that legacy for our future?
Exactly. We're really connected to the families and our communities. You know, we pick up on all these towns and we really feel like we need to get into those schools and we tell that story so that that next generation can continue to, you know, preserve the environment and have clean air.
Sure. As we come to the end of our program, Peter, any closing thoughts?
No, I just wanted to thank you for having me on again and, you know, helping others tell that story about, you know, clean air and clean communities. I really appreciate your efforts to help us tell that story.
Well, Home of Disposal is a great partner, not only here in Indiana, but also in Illinois. I know you guys keep up the great work, and we look forward to partnering with you in the future. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mr. Peter Clevering, Marketing Director for Home of Disposal Service. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible with support from South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Many bars and restaurants in the Midwest face a crisis after being ordered by some states to close because of coronavirus fears. The shutdowns came as bars were getting ready for some big crowds on St. Patrick's Day. As the news hit, Nick Evans reports for Side Effects Public Media from Columbus, Ohio, where The Ohio State University has some 60,000 students.
At the South Village Grill, manager Drew DeBoard tried to decide whether to call that night's reservations. She seemed a bit shocked that her restaurant was closing.
On a scale of 1 to 10, a 10. Nothing like this has ever happened in my lifetime. We live in a world where these types of emergencies aren't real. This is the stuff you see on movies. It's pretty crazy. I have goosebumps just saying it out loud.
Governor Mike DeWine insists that drastic action is necessary to stop the spread of COVID-19. In a press conference Sunday, he hearkened back to the differing responses of St. Louis and Philadelphia during the 1918 influenza outbreak. St. Louis took drastic action to close down public events. Philadelphia held a parade. When it was all said and done, the death rate in Philadelphia was double the rate in St. Louis. DeWine acknowledged these steps are going to be hard for restaurant and bar workers.
Look, this is brutally tough, and my heart goes out to them, but we have to do what we have to do to save their lives, and not just their lives, but the lives of others. And our goal is for us to get through this.
According to the Ohio Restaurant Association, the industry employed more than 500,000 people last year. That's 10% of the state's workforce. In a statement, Association President John Barker said, quote, "It's important we're all in this together, so restaurants are here now and after the crisis." The Chamber of Commerce applauded the governor as well, saying decisive action now will allow the state to return to normal sooner. But Lisa Dublin, a bartender at Highbeck Tavern, was frustrated and angry.
It's pretty shocking. I'm rarely speechless, but today would be one of the first times that I am speechless. The whole thing seems a bit extreme, to be honest.
And without a clear idea of how long this will last, she says her concerns just pile up on top of one another.
How to pay rent, how to feed myself, how to do all of those things. I mean, I'm a career bartender. I'm a cash girl. I don't have a 401k and all kinds of backup that people that do normal jobs have.
Up the street, Luke and Annie Pierce felt like the rug was being pulled out from under them. The couple opened their bar Lawbird just 4 months ago.
We're torn, right? We're small business owners that our livelihood just got stripped out of our hands. But again, to slow the spread of this thing, no one knows the magnitude that it could be.
Annie said the decision means they're no longer in limbo. Still, she said it's hard to prepare when there's so much they don't know.
We have ideas and programs that we've already started to put in place to cover a few weeks worth of, you know, missing work or lost product or things like that. It's the question of what does it look like if, God forbid, this is 6 weeks? I have no answer or idea for that.
At the press conference announcing Sunday's order, DeWine's administration promised to make it easier for people who find themselves out of work to make unemployment claims quickly. The state will also look to the federal government to make low-interest loans available to companies around the state impacted by the order. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Nick Evans.
Well, it hasn't been very long since the last week in February when we found out about how the stock market suffered its worst decline since the financial crisis. But now comes word from the chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell, that the coronavirus could drag the nation's economy into a recession. Well, that may sound like maybe the last recession was a long time ago, but wasn't all that long ago. And Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Haber is with us today to talk about it. Greg, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it seems like just a distant memory, I guess. But I guess the nation's 401ks and IRAs took a beating, I guess, is only about a year or so ago, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that happened in the past and a lot of what we talk to individual, you know, clients about and communicate to people that come through our office is really around the planning aspect of it. I mean, we fully expect that at some point, you know, markets are going to correct and, you know, the economy is going to have recessions. And I think just because of the distance from the most recent one, people kind of get desensitized, you know, and it's like, okay, it's not going to happen. Markets are going to continue. And the reality of it is every indicator that we had prior to this coronavirus was that the economy was strong and mm-hmm. that it would continue on its path. So, you know, a lot of times we don't expect or we get blindsided by something that could derail the market as quickly as this has.
I have a few tips to offer for us here on trying to take a look at this more objectively and making sure you don't make any drastic decisions. And I guess if things start out with just being more of level-headed, I guess, especially when it comes to your finances, maybe you might be concerned for your health, but don't be so panicky about your finances.
Well, and you hit it exactly there, Chris. And I think the biggest thing that we try to educate around is you need a plan. You have to have a plan. And part of that plan is, what is it that I'm going to do or what do I have in place for when, and I always say when, not if, when the market has volatility, when things are not going the way we expected, so that you don't panic or make sudden moves. And it's crucial that you don't let your emotions drive your investment decisions. So if you don't have that plan, that's when emotions allow us to, you know, often make sudden changes or frequent changes, and that usually long-term doesn't bode well for most investors. And, you know, often find themselves selling when they shouldn't be and buying when they shouldn't be, which is exactly what you don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. I guess diversity is probably the best way to take a look at as well when it's taking a look at how your investments are doing and trying to plan for these things, huh?
Absolutely. And diversity, a lot of times, you know, people, just to make them aware of it, it's not just diversity amongst equities or international. A lot of times it's diversity not only with the classes, but how the investments work. And part of that is, are they correlated to the market? Is there a direct relationship? Are there things that we should be doing that are not correlated 100% or directly to the market? And, you know, should we be not only in market investments, but investments that create different type of results than, you know, the normal tracking of the market ebbs and flows, you know, when it goes up and down, and looking at different instruments just to, you know, not react in the same way.
I know we've mentioned this before in our past conversations about the plan and having one set up here so that you're well prepared for when these changes happen, but you should also kind of take a look at a long range and a short range plan as too, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, time horizon is the key. You know, we promote a bucket plan strategy where, you know, the expectation of use of the asset should be a direct consideration as to what that particular investment is. Meaning, really simply, if we know we're going to need the money, you know, if we're near retirement and there's money that we have to dedicate towards creating the income, those vehicles are typically going to be a lot less volatile, you know, a lot less risky. That way you can have monies that is positioned or are positioned, I should say, in the market on a proper time horizon. Meaning, you know, if we're not needing that money for 10, 15, 20 years, then, you know, statistically or predictably results become, you know, more predictable, for lack of a better word. So younger investments, for example, have a longer time horizon. They should expect volatility creates buying opportunities. If we know we're not at least on that longer time horizon, even in retirement, then we just got to understand what the volatility could do to our balances, because balances become, you know, the critical thing in the distribution phase of our lives.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about these very volatile times, and even made more volatile because of the COVID-19 illness that is taking over the country. I remember a long time ago, one of my coworkers used to be a very close watcher of his CREF stock market action. In fact, he would make changes almost seemingly every day. I guess, is that the type of person that you have to determine you are in order to be able to do a wise decision of your finances?
Well, I think there's a couple things. And I think the big part that you mentioned there, Chris, is you need to know yourself, right? What are the type of investor that you are? And really what that starts with is the type of volatility. Now, if you want to be a day trader, that's entirely different. You know, where some people actively look for opportunities. But typically what you're going to find is most people don't have the time to dedicate it in terms of, you know, actually looking for those opportunities, doing the research to understand when those opportunities might come into play, and to actively watch, you know, over the course of hours during the day to see when those opportunities might exist. So most people, when you're knowing yourself, it's really going to be geared around, hey, what is my risk tolerance? You know, if the market were to go down, when am I going to start to get uncomfortable? When is it going to keep me awake at night? And it's important to understand how you react to that market volatility and understand that that should be an expectation. So if we're going to check day-to-day activity and be concerned about the ebbs and flows, we really need to understand that we're probably not an aggressive or high-risk consumer or investor. You know, so we need to look at things that are not going to have as much volatility. So if we're going to be in growth, expectations should be at some point we're going to see fluctuations in the market. If we're not willing to accept those fluctuations, we need to know ourselves and say, you know what, I'm willing to sacrifice upside so that I don't experience the downside, because it is a give and take. And that's, I think a lot of people get caught up in, especially with the historic run we had in the marketplace. They talk to friends, they talk to family about how much money they make, and they're trying to make more money when it doesn't necessarily suit their risk tolerance. And it's just a very direct correlation. We have to understand that growth comes with risk. And if we're not willing to accept the downside of that potential upside, we just really need to get in connection with who we are and what we're willing to tolerate. And again, that plan, right? What is my plan? What are the things I have in place so that I don't make quick emotional decisions?
Well, Greg, the final thing I guess we need to talk about here is following up in the paraphrase, the words of a rapper, don't believe the hype. And that's certainly the case here when you have to look to not only how things have been working, but how the future is going to be for yourself financially.
Yeah, and I think the big thing is, you know, in the big picture of stuff, markets react quicker than they ever have because of technology. When people speak, there's immediate impact on the market, and it's just something that is due to the way things are disseminated now amongst the public. But there are things in the big picture, again, and this goes back to understanding, you know, how markets work, what my plan is, what my tolerance is. But these types of volatilities also create opportunities. Roth conversions, as an example. You know, with the given tax laws, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the Secure Act, Roth conversions are a very prominent discussion, you know, with a lot of clients, something that everybody should be considering. Well, conversion is just a bigger opportunity in marketplaces like this. You know, so how can we lower, you know, the taxes and when we convert and consider historic tax rates and understand when these opportunities come in, you know, they're a buying opportunity, not a selling opportunity. And, you know, too much focus on return and fees often creates a lot of this, you know, and a lot of that is just, again, media-driven. You know, don't pay fees. Well, don't use planners. And when you're not using advisors and planners and you're saving on fees, well, then there's typically not a plan, and it usually leads to emotional mistakes. And, you know, there's not that big picture that can be reinforced by somebody that would be your advocate and, you know, someone that can help talk you off the ledge, so to speak. So, you know, you need to create that plan, create that model that you're going to adhere to, understand what the actionable items are when things like this occur so that, you know, in that time of change, that volatility, we already know what the game plan is, what's the actionable steps we're going to do, and it removes the emotional aspects of it.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with some advice here as we try to deal with finances during what could turn out to be a global. As always, Greg, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
The federal government abruptly put updated travel screenings in place over the weekend to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Darian Benson tells us, a central Indiana woman who flew out of O'Hare International Airport says they may have made the spread worse.
Liz Manasek and her husband returned to the U.S. Saturday after a trip to Iceland. When they arrived in Chicago before a connection to Indianapolis, she says it was chaos.
There are people all over the place, and I start to get increasingly concerned.
Manasek says they stood in a customs line for hours, packed in with others returning from around the world. Then they went to a second line to get their temperature taken. She says it was crowded, with very little guidance, and there appeared to be no sanitary precautions.
We did not pick up the coronavirus in Iceland. We picked up the coronavirus in O'Hare International Airport with 1,000 other people.
Manasek does not believe the airport was prepared for the influx of returning travelers. Federal officials say the situation was unacceptable but has improved. Manasek and her husband must quarantine for 14 days. So far, they have no symptoms of COVID-19. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Darian Benson.
A Hoosier distillery is shifting production to produce hand cleaner in response to the coronavirus. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the company's decision aims to help at-risk communities.
With the coronavirus pandemic, demand is outpacing the supply of many products, including hand sanitizer. Hotel Tango Distillery CEO Travis Barnes says seeing people online incorrectly producing hand cleaner at home pushed him to use his company to make a product that meets the federal safety standards.
We have the facility, we have the ingredients on hand to really produce that, so we kind of just shifted gears to produce actual hand cleaner.
Barnes says the company is expecting to receive federal approval soon that would allow them to start shipping the cleaner. The company is planning to send its first batches to organizations that have reached out and are serving some of the most vulnerable to the virus. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking. Although schools are closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic, there is still the issue of homework when classes resume. It's tough for parents who can't answer all of their students' questions when it comes to some subjects, but there is still help out there. Once again, Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute is offering up an opportunity for homework help for math and science subjects to Northwest Indiana students. We have with us to talk about the famous program known as Ask Rose. We have the director of Ask Rose, Susan Smith Rhodes, with us. Susan, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Well, thank you for encouraging your students.
It's been around for a while. Give us a little history lesson.
Ask Rose actually started in 1991 by Rose Holman. We had students who were calling and asking for some homework help, and so we decided that we would start Ask Rose. And it's a free service to helping students with their math and science. We focus on grades 6 through 12, and students can call us, they can chat, or they can email and get the help that they need.
How many tutors are available out there each evening that you make the this opportunity available?
More than 30 tutors available each evening. We have 140 tutors who actually work with the program. All of our tutors are Rose Holman students, so they're math, science, and engineering majors, and so they're very technically qualified. They also complete a training process and with communication skills. So their goal is to help students with their math and science the way that those subjects are taught in schools today.
Now, if a student has some problems that they're working on for an assignment that they have to turn in the next day, they've done all right to a point, but they've gotten stuck, how can they contact the folks at Ask Rose, and what kind of help can you offer them?
They can contact us at 877-ASK-ROSE, just a phone call away, or they can go to our website at askrose.org, and they can chat or email. And we're open Sundays through Thursdays. We are in Eastern Time, so it's 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time or 6 to 9 Central Time.
When you have so many students involved with such an effort to try to help students out on the phone or online to get their math or science questions answered, what kind of resources do you all have to work with to try to get those answers?
Well, we have a lot of computer resources. We also have math and science textbooks for the state of Indiana. But if a student is also just working on a worksheet, the student can send us the worksheet and submit that to us. So we want to make sure that the student is comfortable, and we'll help the student in the manner in which the student is most comfortable. We also have about 500 online resources that can be found on our website.
Wow. Now, with all that help that you can offer up to students, there has to be some good news that comes back to you after getting a student out of a particularly tough problem. Do you ever get any word back on thank you for helping me out?
Yes, we do. We do assessments every evening of the program, and we'll ask students, did the tutor spend enough time helping you? Could you answer a similar problem? And our assessment shows that 99% of the students say they would use the service again and that they're very satisfied.
That's wonderful news to hear, and it's always out there available. Once again, this 877-ASK-ROSE, that's on the phone, or you can go to the Ask Rose website, which is askrose.org. And Susan Smith-Rhodes with Rose Holman Institute of Technology, thank you for joining us and telling us about, once again, a very popular and very informative and helpful program that will help high school students out with their math and science work. The Depot Museum and Art Gallery in Beverly Shores is getting ready with its 2020 season. On May 8th, with the annual fundraising exhibit, which is called 5x5 at the Depot. And with us to talk about it, we have one of the board members for the Depot Museum and Art Gallery, Dr. Karen Brown. And Dr. Brown, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm so glad to be able to get the word out about this little gem that we have in Beverly Shores.
Well, that's the best way to put it, I think. Many people probably don't even, they maybe have driven by the Depot Museum and Art Gallery, but they thought, oh, it's just an old train station, but it's more than that.
It is more than that. And actually, it grew out of wanting to save that old train station from demolition. So we just had our 20th anniversary. 20 years ago, a group of people got together and had the building put on the register of historic places and then embarked on rehabilitating it and making it something relevant for today. So in addition to being a train station, it is a small museum and art gallery and has some really interesting exhibits throughout the year.
One of the things that I've had mentioned to me, I have not seen it, at least this exhibit in particular, but it's such a unique exhibit in itself. How did the idea of the 5x5 at the Depot come about? Who created this idea? And if somebody wants to come and visit the exhibit for this year, what will they see?
Okay, well, it started. This is our third annual 5x5 at the Depot, and it began as we were brainstorming ideas for fundraising because we're a nonprofit. We rely on grants and donations and unique fundraisers to fund the programs that we put up every year. And so, you know, talking about different kinds of things that we might do to raise funds. And because we're an art gallery, we wanted to do something that had art involved in it. And a couple of years ago, I had become aware of this modality of having art, small pieces of artwork, donated to nonprofits. And then those nonprofits make those works available to visitors at a set price or rate. And because we open in May, we decided to go with 5x5. So each piece of art that we offer is 5 inches by 5 inches. And we last year had over 100 donated pieces of art. And you line them up in the gallery, and it is like this visual smorgasbord of interesting pieces in an array of medium.
Yeah, when you talk about the array of medium, what things do the artists that contribute their works for the project, for the exhibit itself, what do they use? Or what do they do when they come up with a 5x5 item?
We don't tell them or give them any directive about their art other than it has to fit in and be the dimensions of 5 inches wide, 5 inches high, and if they make a three-dimensional piece, less than 5 inches, mm-hmm. and it has to hang on the wall. So we have had the traditional medium of watercolor, acrylic, oil paintings. But then we also have rock, glass. Once we had a piece made of coffee grounds that was very interesting. So imagine the artist's mind gone wild, and anything is acceptable as long as it is tastefully done.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know the call for artists went out here not long ago, and how long has it been underway here? Because obviously you want to have things all together so that you have everything turned in so you can get the exhibit set up here by May 8th.
Right. So March 1st, we will provide canvases and frames. So canvases for people who work in, say, acrylics or oils, frames for people who work in photography or watercolor or some other kind of medium, or artists can use whatever substrate they desire.
Mm-hmm.
We make the canvases and frames available, and artists can pick them up at Glen L. Firm on Highway 12 in Beverly Shores. So they pick them up, they create their piece of art, they bring it back and donate it to the Depot, same drop-off location, and that, I think we need them back by mid-April so that we can then get everything hung in the Depot and be ready to go by May 8th.
Uh-huh. Now, if anybody has any questions about this, obviously they can get hold of you folks there at the museum and art gallery to find out more. Is there a website and address that people can check out if they'd like to find out in particular what these exhibits really look like and maybe to contribute this year?
Thank you so much for asking. The Depot's website is thedepotmag.org. And the MAG stands for Museum and Gallery. So mm-hmm. thedepotmag.org is our website. And you can see this exhibit and the entire year's exhibit for the 2020 season. You can also email me at thedepotmag, as in gallery,
mm-hmm.
@gmail.com. And I can send, if an artist would like to participate, I can send them an entire document that explains what we're doing, why we're doing this, etc. Last year, the funds that we raised allowed us to purchase a new sign for out in front of our building.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
So people not only had a chance to be in the exhibit and help contribute, and the proceeds from the event actually help to make it possible for more people to visit the Depot Museum and Art Gallery this year, to be sure. So.
Absolutely. And another interesting aspect of this exhibit is visitors buy what we call a claim ticket. And on this claim ticket is a numbered red dot. Now, in the art world, a red dot means that a particular piece of artwork is sold. So at 5 p.m., we open the gallery, and visitors can come in at that point in time and use their numbered red dot to select the piece of art that they would like to claim for their own.
Well, that's
great. So there's an element of first come, first serve. So if there's an artist that you like, that you know that is participating, but it's a popular artist, we recommend that you come early so that you get the best chance of claiming it and making it your own.
That's Karen Brown, who is one of the board members of the Depot Museum and Art Gallery in Beverly Shores. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.